Are you ready to experience the rich interconnection of spirituality, orientation, and identity? If so, plan to attend Liberating Your Divine Identity, a retreat at Unity Village during Pride Month, June 9th to the 12th. This soul-filled retreat is facilitated by LGBTQIA+ Unity Ministers, with workshops and ceremonies to cultivate a deeper awareness of our spiritual nature. Register at unityvillage.org/IAmDivine2022.
You're listening to Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Welcome to World Spirituality, exploring the unity within all cultures and faith traditions, with your host, Reverend Paul John Roach.
So hello and welcome to World Spirituality on the Unity Online Radio Network. Yes, I'm your host, Paul John Roach, coming to you from a spring day in Fort Worth, Texas. It's looking a little overcast. We're having one of our spring days that bring a little bit of a rain here to beat the humidity, so that's nice. Today I welcome a sociologist of religion, award-winning author, and frequent television, radio, podcast, and print media commentator on social issues. That's a mouthful. Dr. Tricia Bruce to the show. Her books include Parish and Place, Making Room for Diversity in the American Catholic Church, and Faithful Revolution, How the Voice of the Faithful is Changing the Church. Today, she's going to give us a snapshot of religion in the U.S. I've been looking forward to this for weeks now, so it's finally here. I want to get a snapshot of religion in the U.S. It's an honor and a joy, therefore, to welcome Dr. Tricia C. Bruce to today's show. Welcome. Glad you're with us.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here. It's sunny here in Knoxville, Tennessee, where I am.
All right, you're in Knoxville, aren't you? Sort of up in the Appalachians a little bit, right?
Exactly. Yeah, near the Great Smoky Mountains. So we're happy to see spring. But I originally am from Texas, so I feel like once a Texan, always a Texan.
There we go. Absolutely. Well, there's some wonderful things in both states. I was in Nashville recently myself, and that was a fun town too to explore. So
it is.
You know, things are not the same, are they? I've been a minister now for 33 years, and when I first grew my church back in the 80s and early 90s, it was very different from when I was rebuilding it again after a difficult time in the 2010s. Totally different way of doing business, right? Everything's changed, and I hear this across Unity, which is our denomination or our movement, but I also hear it, you know, throughout the Christian communion, really, that, you know, people are not coming to church like they used to, or they're seeking other things rather than Sunday services, etc. So I'm fascinated to learn, you know, what you know about this. I know you've done in-depth study, especially in the Catholic tradition, right, but also across the boards.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as a sociologist of religion, we try to pay attention to some of these trends and understanding, you know, to what extent do people identify with particular religious affiliations? How often do they attend worship services? How involved are they? What are their levels of belief? And yeah, just as you mentioned, you know, we are seeing some pretty substantial change in the U.S. religious landscape. And certainly there's some stability too, and it's not like religion is suddenly disappearing. So I don't think we need to sound an alarm. But at the same time, in particular, with regard to folks who are identifying without a particular religious affiliation, these numbers are really growing. So sociologists call these the nones, or the N-O-N-E, don't claim a formal religious affiliation, or sometimes called the unaffiliated. It's a diverse group, but when we look at these numbers, they've really grown, so much so that there was some data that came out just a couple weeks ago from the General Social Survey that suggests that the nuns or the religiously unaffiliated are roughly on par with Catholics and with evangelicals as a proportion of the U.S. population. So about a quarter Catholics, just shy thereof, about a quarter evangelicals, and about a quarter non-affiliated, and then a quarter something else. And so you can really see how this has changed, certainly compared to older profiles of the religious landscape of the U.S.
So is this due to the age group we're talking about? Are millennials less likely to? I've heard this anecdotally that millennials are less likely to attend church, you know, like their parents or grandparents did. They're more independent minded.
Yeah, that's absolutely a part of it. You know, sociologists tend to call this generational replacement. But another way to say it is just the reality that, hey, you know, we all will die at some point. And if you look at the patterns of affiliation among the oldest Americans, they're much more likely to affiliate, to say that they are, you know, whether it's Presbyterian or Jewish or Catholic or otherwise, among the oldest Americans. So those who were in the silent generation, so roughly 1928 to 1945, only about 11% of that generation is unaffiliated, which, you know, in itself is still noticeable. You know, about 1 in 10 of the oldest among us saying that they're unaffiliated. But when you compare that to the youngest, so looking at millennials and especially the younger millennials, so the youngest millennials, you know, 1990 to 96 or so birth cohorts, then it's more than a third. It's actually about 36%. Say that they are religiously unaffiliated. And that doesn't mean that they're not religious in different ways, but when you ask them, well, what are you or what do you affiliate with? They're the ones who are most likely to say, nothing in particular. So you're absolutely right that there's a big generational component behind this.
And of course, the phrase spiritual but not religious has been talked about for several years now, right? That people, you know, have an antipathy to religion and all that all the various baggage that comes with it, I guess you could say. Whereas being spiritual is you know, you can go to a yoga studio and be spiritual, right? You don't necessarily have to go to church. You can be interested in New Age texts or whatever, or listen to Oprah or whatever, and think yourself spiritual. So, I don't need to go into a church community as such.
Right. Yeah, I think that there's something there in terms of, you know, there are certainly different ways to think about what religion is, what spirituality is. Is it belief? Is it holding on to a particular formal doctrine or set of religious tenets? Is it practice? Is it an organization? And, you know, I think to the last point about it being an organization, I think part of what we're seeing in terms of the rise of those who are unaffiliated is a real skepticism towards religion as institution or religious organizations or religious authorities, religious leaders. I would say sometimes even over and above skepticism towards belief. You know, certainly the skepticism towards belief is a piece of this too when you talk to those who are unaffiliated. But for a lot of folks, it's not that. You know, they still believe in God. They still pray. They still consider themselves religious, and yet they don't affiliate, perhaps because there's this level of doubt or hesitancy to belong to something. And we're seeing this not just in religion, you know, a real hesitancy to belong to other community groups or to stay occupied or employed with one workplace for multiple years. You know, people are I think, treating organizations and institutions differently than they once did in terms of a long-term stable affiliation.
If you could, posit some reasons why this is happening, you know, what would you say? For me, I think something, a sea change happened when, you know, the terrible destruction on 9/11. I don't think we've even begun to understand, you know, what happened there. You know, the shift in the consciousness of America. I think, you know, sociologists, historians in the future are going to look back and see it in a way we can't see it because we're too close to it, you know. But I think something happened, didn't it, that's dramatic there. So let's talk about that. What's your thoughts?
Yeah. I think there is, I think it's right to kind of look at what are some of the dynamics of what has changed culturally, some of the global events. Also, you know, I would say too, relatedly, some people have a disdain for what they see as an overly close linkage between religion and politics. And the rejection of that linkage means for some then the rejection of religion, or at least a religious affiliation or organization. And so I think people are, Americans in particular right now are starting to rethink, well, what does this look like? And another thing I would throw in here too, is that, for many people, they're delaying marriage and perhaps delaying also having children or not having children. And we also often think about the role of religion as it ties into, well, when we get married, we go to church and get married. And then when we have a family, that's when we come back to the church, right? Even if there's a period of being away. But the age of first marriage is higher than it's ever been. And so I think people might view the role of religion in their lives functionally for themselves, for their relationships, for their families and their children, in somewhat different ways. Whereas before that was the expectation. Well, of course even if you went away from the church for a while, eventually you came back.
Right. Yes, exactly. Another thing that strikes me too, is the rise in awareness, in the people's awareness of Islam, as a result of events in the last 30 years or so, especially since the revolutions in Iran, etc., and the distaste for religion, because the antipathy between Islam and Christianity, and like you said, the overly politicized nature of it, right? It's hard to separate, and people continually say, well, Islam is a religion of peace, it's not a religion of fanaticism, but we're bombarded by the latest fanatical outrage, which, was in Sri Lanka this week, right? And you say enough with it, I don't want to be involved with any kind of religion because it's sick, it's a destructive force. It's not pushing our planet forward.
Yeah. I think that these kinds of events certainly put religion in the limelight in some really negative ways, absolutely, whether it's linked to violence or conflict in communities, or certainly as someone who has studied the Catholic Church in particular, the crisis within the Catholic Church of abuse, these are the sorts of things that really make it difficult on a more personal level for someone to say, well, why would I believe, or why would I belong? And I think, for a long time, people predicted that religious pluralism itself would lead to secularization. So this idea that, well, if you have multiple religions in a given society, then that's going to create irreconcilable conflict or dissonance, and that will eventually lead to religious decline. Now, for a long time, America kind of bucked that trend. The United States was this really exceptional space where we had, and we still do, have higher levels of religious attendance, worship service attendance, higher levels of affiliation, higher levels of belief in God, particularly when we compare to other wealthy nations. But now, we are seeing the rise of the nuns, and I think it might be in some ways linked to these global shifts around how we think about religion. Although I will add to that, though, too, that most, if you ask people how they view religion, there's still for many a positive view of religion's role, that religion can bring people together, can strengthen community bonds, can do important work to serve the poor and the needy. And this is true even of folks who don't necessarily affiliate themselves. So I think there's a mixed view, but perhaps there's also an opening or an increasing space for folks to bring that kind of skepticism and dislike in a way that there wasn't before.
Yeah, interesting. When I first came to the States and about 40 years ago from Britain, you know, I grew up in Britain, and you're absolutely right. You know, the Church of England has been dying ever since I was a kid.
Right.
I'm amazed it still goes, actually, because it shrinks. It's the great shrinking edifice, you know. Every time I visit in continental Europe, you know, it's less so in the southern parts where, you know, the Latin countries where Catholicism is still fairly strong. But if you go to the northern parts of Europe, the Nordic lands, whatever, you know, nobody goes to church. They may go for, you know, weddings or whatnot, but not as a worship experience. So, yeah, become very secularized. But I've seen that happen in the States. It's almost as if America retained its innocence, you know. It's a young country, right? But that innocence seems to have been lost, you know. I think the Vietnam War and then the you know, the horrors of what we just talked about, 9/11, of it sort of took the bloom off it or something, and people have become a little more cynical. Yeah.
Well, you know, the fascinating thing about the United States is that it was founded on this premise of religious freedom, which is not true for so many countries. And that premise of religious freedom really created fertile ground for religion to thrive in surprising ways, you know, ways that were surprising to sociologists. So there's essentially a marketplace of religion. You know, there are still to this day, you know, there are so many congregations, communities of locally organized religious adherents. And for every stripe, you know, if you like this kind of music, if you share this ethnic identity or language, if you need childcare, you know, there's a congregation for you. In fact, if you look at, if you were to count up all the congregations in the U.S., there are more congregations than there are all of the top 10 fast food establishments combined. So there are still so many. And yet, yeah, exactly what you're talking about, you know, who's there and who's attending. And I think we are, well, those are still a dominant part of the U.S. landscape. I think we're also seeing the shift in, you know, especially in mainline Protestantism, in the demographics of who's in the pews, and then the rise of the nuns that is starting to really reshape the landscape of the U.S. And I would say even in a physical way, you know, you look at all those congregations that have church property. What happens to those when these kinds of changes begin to happen?
Right. Absolutely. You know, for many years, you know, there seems to be a battle going on between the more, we could call them progressive liberal forces within religion, within denominations, and then the more retrenching, you know, fundamentalist churches and who have been fairly successful, right, in holding people in the pews, maybe because they speak a more fear-based, you know, shame-based religion. I don't know, but sometimes they've moved into the prosperity sort of teaching, right? You know, have all the things you want and everything, which attracts people. But do you think that's true? Is there this great void? It seems to be along political lines too, to a degree. You know, because we hear the religious right, you know, speaking in glowing terms of political leaders, and then you've got your far left folks who, you know, speaking of this war against the 1% and the privileged few, etc., and, you know, a more sort of radical Jesus-based social gospel kind of thing.
Yeah. I think that religion tends to embed these kinds of social divides that we see more broadly. You know, if you look, even just looking at congregations by way of example, you know, congregations are pretty divided in a number of ways and oftentimes reflect various ends of the spectrum when it comes to political ideology or other forms of social division, certainly along the lines of race. You know, congregations remain very racially segregated, which can magnify these same kinds of lines of political separation, which in some ways is ironic because, you know, many of the core tenets of religious beliefs will espouse a message of unity and bringing people together, right, and crossing divides. And a lot of the social activism that has been motivated by religion and organized by religion tries to overcome this kind of cognitive divide. And yet, absolutely, what we're seeing, you know, even among Catholics, for example, you know, today Catholics don't fit very neatly into one party or another. And yet, so they tend to be split, you know, split almost evenly between Republican and Democrat identifications, which then, you know, what happens to that? What does that conversation look like? And sometimes even within congregations or across congregations, you see politics play out in religion, doing the very opposite of what perhaps the religion thinks or desires to do in terms of bringing people together.
Right. Yeah. Interesting. Well, the Catholic Church is at an interesting point in its history, isn't it, right now, with, as you mentioned, the scandals, the abuse, but also the endless renewal that seems to happen in the Catholic communion. You know, that's what's remarkable to me about Catholic history is its ability to reinvent itself. You know, after the Reformation, it was like, whoa, what's going to happen next? And then you had this resurgence, right? The Counter-Reformation resurgence, and some of the great writers, some of the great mystics came out of that. And I'm thinking today, you know, people like Father Richard Rohr, if you're familiar with him. Mm-hmm. In Albuquerque, you know, the Center for Action and Contemplation speaks an almost pure non-dual message, you know, the message of oneness, which is very familiar to us in Unity. And yet he's, you know, he's persona non grata in some, you know, Catholic churches. I did a wedding actually in a Catholic church with a Catholic priest, and I thought that was nice that they would allow me to do that. But I brought his name up, and it was like, that was the end of the conversation. You know, right. The name was brought up, and then we don't talk about him.
That's it. No, there is. I mean, having thought quite a bit about this, you know, I have one of my books is an edited volume on polarization in the church, and it's true. I mean, part of these debates go back to, well, who owns the church, who speaks for the church, and I think right now there's a reckoning right now. You know, there is a heightened scrutiny for good reason placed upon, you know, how does authority and power work in the Catholic Church, and where do these fault lines come from? You know, in the most horrific instance, that of abuse, but even beyond that, you know, who is included and who is not. But the other piece of this, and the one that you referenced too, is that absolutely, you know, that the Catholic Church does have this phenomenal way of renewing itself and inviting new people in. You know, right now, the Catholic Church in the United States has a higher proportion of foreign-born Catholics than it's ever had. And this is an immigrant church, you know, from the outset, really. And so who are these, you know, newcomers to the church? And oftentimes it's through immigrants and through the youngest Catholics who are questioning the church in different ways that vitality comes, you know, and new thinking comes. But I do think this is something that leaders are having to think through very carefully. You know, what does the church of the future look like? Because there is this deep reckoning happening amidst that renewal.
Right. Yeah. Interesting. Fascinating stuff. And we're going through the same thing in our own little tiny denomination. You know, Unity is just a little blip compared to the mighty Catholic Church. But, you know, which we're about 130 years old now. We're beginning to look at, you know, what happened to us, you know, because we had a sort of a niche, you know, at one point, but it's become commonplace now. You know, a lot of the Methodists, Catholics and others are speaking the same message that, you know, we've been speaking. And so how do we fit in? You know, how are we different? Why do we exist? And, you know, it's an interesting question, and nobody really knows. It's, again, you don't have the benefit of that kind of global view, right? When you're so involved with it, sometimes you can't see the you know, the proverbial wood for the trees sort of thing. You know, it's hard, and I guess that's why we have people like you, and fortunately, right, who spend their time, you know, attempting to look from that higher perspective and seeing trends, etc.
Yeah, I think it is worth that that pause to think through, you know, what are the connective threads? How does that history shape what's happening now? But yeah, I mean, of course, the tough part for all of us, sociologists included, is that it's really hard to know what is coming in the future. So it's hard to guess what these trends look like. But, you know, the Catholic Church being so big means that there are also a lot of ex-Catholics, former Catholics, or those who would consider themselves cultural Catholics even. And so in that way, Catholicism and religion in a broader way, I think, has a diffusion throughout society that goes beyond just that formal religious affiliation. So even if someone doesn't say, I'm Catholic or I affiliate, there's still something there. And I think to me, that's a really fruitful and interesting way to think about what does the future of religion look like as we change our patterns of affiliation, but maybe still culturally identify in different ways religiously.
I think I'm an example of that. You know, I'm obviously part of Unity, but my favorite mystic is Meister Eckhart, you know, a Catholic. And I love Thomas Merton and some of the other greats, you know, in the Catholic tradition. So, you know, I very much resonate with that. I wouldn't by any stretch call myself a Catholic. And yet, you know, in some sense I am, you know, so, but it's okay, right? It's,
right.
I've never found it a problem. I like Hinduism. I think there's a lot of virtue, you know, in some of the spiritual psychology of that tradition, but, that doesn't necessarily make me a Hindu, but so, yeah, it's not being syncretic, you know, it's not trying to make it all fit into one. It's enjoying the flavor, I think, the broad variety of things. Folks, okay. I'm with Dr. Tricia Bruce, and we're talking about a very fascinating subject, the nature of religion in America today. We're going to take a break, listen to these messages from Unity, and we'll be right back. Join us then.
Discover the power within. Unity Online Radio. The voice of an awakening world.
You're listening to Unity Online Radio. This programming is made possible through the generous donations of listeners like you. If you feel inspired by this programming, we invite you to contribute. Go to unityonlineradio.org and click on Donate to make your offering today. Thank you for your support.
Here's Reverend Paul Hasselbeck with a Unity Teachable Moment, taken from a talk at Unity on the River in Amesbury, Massachusetts.
All good is defined as divine mind, God, and I love this, the principle of divine benevolence that permeates the universe. So God is not good like a Boy Scout or a Girl Scout. God is the good, the principle of benevolence. And benevolence is basically the disposition to do good or to treat others well and things like that. And so in that moment, when you're not wanting to offer grace to somebody, you can remember at the very point of view is this principle of benevolence. And as we remember that, we can draw on it, and then we use that principle to offer grace.
To find more from Reverend Paul Hasselbeck, visit the radio archives at unityonlineradio.org.
This is Biotech. The year is 2149, and the world has become a very dark place. People have augmented their bodies with technology to the point they are no longer human. Yet one brilliant and determined scientist wants to bring the human spirit back to this bleak planet and begins to develop 12 divine attributes that were born in her. Check out the Biotech comic book series from Unity Books, available at biotechcomic.com.
Join Travel with Unity 2020 for a transformational trip to Rome and the Amalfi Coast, March 26th to April 4th, and explore the culture, myths, and spiritual significance of southern Italy. You'll experience the history of the ancient ruins of Pompeii, visit the Vatican, and spend time on the beautiful Amalfi Coast during this 10-day tour. Just 40 seats are available and space is limited, so reserve your trip before September 15th. Go to unity.org/travel for more information today.
Do you dread going to work every day and just pray for Friday? Get a fresh perspective on your career with Mo Fall and bring your soul to work every Thursday at 11 a.m. Central, 12 p.m. Eastern, here on UnityOnlineRadio.org. A leadership mentor and career coach, Mo can help you go from underpaid, unsatisfied, and unappreciated to loving your life and career again. Join the show and let Mo guide you to make some real life changes. Tune in every Thursday here on UnityOnlineRadio.org.
Call now with your question or comment. 816-251-3555. That's 816-251-3555.
We now return to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach.
Welcome back to today's show. I'm with Dr. Tricia Bruce. She's a sociologist of religion, award-winning author, and we're talking about religion in America today. And we talked about it in the sort of a macro way, but in the second segment, I wanted to talk about specifics that can be creative. You know, just because some things are not functioning quite like they did in the past doesn't mean that, you know, things are going bad. It just means that there's a morphing going on, a different way of doing stuff. And as we said, we want to make sure that it's just not a general decline, because I know many churches. My brother-in-law went to a Catholic church for Easter, and there were 5,000 people there, and you know, it's a thriving community. And as you mentioned earlier, Tricia, it's a lot of it is Hispanic and immigrant church, you know, so there's a lot of people, you know, who are bolstering the church, the Catholic Church, because they're coming from, you know, third world countries or outside of the U.S. And, you know, I know some Unity churches that are thriving, and then there's others that are shutting up shop because nobody wants to come anymore. So it's too simplistic, isn't it, to say that there's a well, nothing is ever simplistic, I guess, right? There's great successes, even in the midst sort of a general decline.
Yeah, I think there absolutely is. I mean, you know, even at the outset, it's important to pay attention to what might be called a decline. But, you know, the United States is still incredibly religious on a variety of levels, for one, and in terms of levels of affiliation, levels of participation. But even among those who are unaffiliated or who don't take this sort of standard view or participation in religion as others do, there's a lot of complexity there. There's a lot of nuance. There's, you know, a lot of the folks who don't affiliate do still show up on, whether it's on Christmas or Easter, or they can still consider themselves religious in different ways. They still pray. They may send their children to schools that have a religious affiliation. They engage in different ways in community. And that's just on the religion side. And then you can sort of define more broadly what does community look like beyond that. But I think the temptation is to look at the headline and think, oh no, you know, religion has disappeared, therefore community has disappeared. And, you know, depending on the audience or the slant you're taking, this of course is really concerning. But on the other hand, I think that there's a way to think, well, people maybe are just rethinking labels, rethinking their participation. But then also this is an opportunity for us as a community of Americans to rethink what community looks like.
Right. And social media is a huge part of that. And that it's a double-edged sword, right? It cocoons us in our own little world where we've got our eyes down in texts or whatever. And then yet it opens up us to, you know, a very large world, because, you know, personally, I've met and conversed and become friends with several people that I've met on social media, you know, and it's been fascinating in the way that, for instance, this show couldn't have happened. It's when years ago, you know, we wouldn't have had the technology to do it. And so, you know, every man, a priest, right, said Luther, every man, you know, somebody who can speak forth the truth in their own way, or every woman, I should say, you know, so that's kind of cool, isn't it? It's a democratization that's happened because of social media.
Yeah, there is. There's a democratization and even a flattening of authority and a shrinking of distance between us that social media introduces. You know, suddenly we have the capacity to interact with others who before we just saw them on the television, you know, and now, you know, they may, you know, interact with us on Twitter or otherwise, or we may befriend people who are, you know, wholly apart from us geographically or politically or otherwise. And yeah, there are lots of benefits to this. There's a social media introduces a new way of thinking about community more asynchronously, more you know, community without propinquity, right? We don't necessarily have to be right next to each other physically in order to build that community. Now, of course, there are negative sides to this too, but the, you know, on the positive side, absolutely. I think a lot of us have stories where we have been able to, whether it's keep in touch with our own family and friends better, or meet new people in ways that were just unimaginable, even a couple decades ago. You know, pretty rapid change on this front.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable, and I must say I like it. You know, I know some people rail against it and say, you know, I hate Facebook or whatever, Instagram, but you know, on the whole, I see it has its, you know, downside, but I think it brings great benefits, so it's wonderful in that sense. So unfortunately, you know, the old ways of approach could still, you know, infiltrate, right? So now we have influencers, you know, these people who supposedly know better than we do, so that we got to listen to them or whatever. But again, I guess that's always going to be, if you've got a certain expertise, you know, people want to listen to what you have to say. I know if Father Raw, for instance, sends out 250,000 emails a day, I think, to his followers, you know, who get the daily message or whatever, which is great, you know, because usually those messages are very, very uplifting, right? But it is still a form of, what's the word? I want to say mind control, but
I think that might be fair, right? I think the risk too is that because of the way that these algorithms work, you know, we can essentially create our own world, and that world feeds itself, you know, and so we can silo ourselves and we can filter out ideas that we may disagree with, filter in those that we do agree with, you know, put up blinders to those who have very different experiences or backgrounds or opinions from our own. And you know, this is, again, this has some strengths in the sense of building identity, perhaps identity, especially among those who are otherwise marginalized in the broader population. It's great to feel like, oh, my kind, my people, those who agree with me. But I think we can also see lots of evidence of really harmful effects of this, and maybe in ways that we don't even fully acknowledge or recognize. You know, we spend our time scrolling through and reading these messages of these influences that we choose to have in our own feeds. And that's a powerful mind shaper, you know, and I'm a sociologist, not a psychologist, but there are some real social implications for, you know, what we consume in terms of media, social media, and how our narratives about social issues get framed. So then when we go to vote or when we interact with others who are different from us, we're going to be bringing those frames and those social boundaries that have been hardened through that filter that can make it harder to get along.
And you know, so often it's in bite-sized pieces, isn't it? It's a tweet-sized thing, yeah, or a sound bite, right? Or a harangue by somebody, yeah, you know. So we never can have an honest discourse. It's usually like back to that polarization again, so that you tend to, you know, move away from it and say, well, I don't want to put up with that, you know, I don't want somebody haranguing me here, so I'll go into my little tribe, and it would be nice if we could have forums, you know, where there could be more measured thoughts, you know, that seems to be lacking sometimes.
You
know, and I know there are, you know, social media outlets that are more thoughtful, obviously, but Facebook and Instagram, some of those and Twitter, you know, tends to be a little bit less sophisticated sometimes.
Yeah. No, it does. It puts the onus on the consumer to be a thoughtful consumer of this, right? To, you know, not just read the headline, maybe to go and read a full book or.
Right.
I think, you know, on the tweet size pieces too, you know, this is, and I think this is a place perhaps where we bemoan the decline in whether it's religious affiliation or other forms of brick and mortar community, because there's something about being face to face when if someone says something, you can't just delete what they've said or turn your head and walk away. You know, there's something about the art of engagement face to face that forces us to think through what we're saying and the consequences of it in a way that maybe social media doesn't. And so there are some lessons and I think cultural norms that are still being established around what does it mean to have fruitful engagement when we're not face to face, because this risk of real disdain and hatred even is so strong.
There's a sense of being, you know, in your own little cocoon. You know, you're protected. You're in your own little world. So it's okay for me to put things out that I wouldn't probably not dare to do if I was face to face with someone, because it wouldn't be socially acceptable. You know, it wouldn't even be morally acceptable. Maybe, you know, that I would challenge somebody unless I was a total bore or whatever. And I think it's the same thing with getting in our cars. You know, we feel cocooned and safe, so we act like complete idiots on the road half the time, you know. But we probably wouldn't act like that if I was passing somebody on, you know, just walking down the street. I wouldn't be, you know, flipping them off and beeping at them and trying to cut them off, etc., you know, because that would be kind of crazy, you know.
Yeah.
So it's interesting, isn't it, how our morality is and our behavior is, you know, except is extremely relative to the medium that in which it, you know, presents itself.
Yeah, I think it is. And, you know, I think that something that this kind of engagement teaches us, though, is that even if people may say when they're in front of someone else one thing, they may actually think and then write online later something wholly different. And while that may be uncomfortable, I think it also provides you know, some glimpse into, hey, if we are a society that is striving for some sort of common good or moral trajectory that, oh, for example, reduces inequality or something like that, then, you know, then seeing this kind of, you know, fire online of people who perhaps are hiding behind the veneer of anonymity tells us that, yeah, there's still a ways to go. Whereas, you know, otherwise we might think, oh, we've had, you know, civil rights and we've had XYZ movements and look, we're in such good shape now as a society, everything is resolved. But these kinds of things give, you know, real clear evidence that no, in fact, there, you know, there's a long way to go in terms of building unity and bridging the divides that people feel so deeply about.
Absolutely. We can sort of fool ourselves into thinking that, you know, those problems are behind us, like you said, and you know, and they're not, right? It's the opposite, in fact, you know.
Yeah.
They've sort of been whitewashed or whatever, and you know, there's a lot still to deal with. Yeah. All right, a direct question, shift gears, a direct question. Live streaming of services, good or a bad idea?
You know, I suppose it depends on what it is, although I guess the whole point is that you don't have the filter of what it is before it's already out there. I don't know. Of course, the ones that we hear about are the ones that are really negative, you know, the things that, and I'll say on this front to you, I'm a parent. And so I think about my kids' consumption of media and I try to be mindful of what they are seeing. And they're still pretty young. They're 7 and 9 years old. But with things that are filtered, at least I know what's there. With a lot, you know, the live stream, this is a, this is sort of uncharted territory that certainly as a parent, I'm very mindful of.
Right. And what about, you know, church services being streamed, you know, as they happen? So so you don't have to go. You can watch it, you know, in the comfort of your own room. Some people say, well, that's great, because if I couldn't go on Sunday, I can still watch the service. But others will say, well, there's no need for me to go anymore because I can watch it at home, you know, in my pajamas or whatever.
No, that's a great point. I mean, this of course will vary by denomination too. You know, among Catholics, it would not fulfill the sacramental requirement unless, I think there may be some sort of exception for those who are, you know, unable physically to go, and then you can watch, you know, EWTN or whatever it might be in order to consume it. But you know, I think this is the question of, well, are those who are not attending anymore, is this are they coming back? Is this are they gone forever? Is this a diminishing of those who are consuming religion, or is it actually an expansion of a market? And if it's an expansion of a market, then it means, okay, people are not showing up on Sunday morning or whatever it might be, but look at all these people who still say that they're interested in religion. They want to participate in some way. And so maybe it does mean creatively presenting a different kind of service, or live streaming something. I haven't seen a lot of data on that on the sociology side. There may be some out there. I'm not sure. I would be interested just to see what the level of participation and people's reaction to that is. Of course, there's a long history too of the drive-in congregation, you know, and the Crystal Cathedral and these sorts of dynamics of creative responses to try to get people to see religion and religious service as a more attractive option amid an otherwise busy schedule. But it's a challenging thing.
Yeah, you mentioned the Crystal Cathedral, which is an interesting example, isn't it? Because it started, as you said, as a drive-in, right, back in in a different age there in California. But then it sort of reached its zenith, and died, basically. I think they closed the Crystal Cathedral. So it was almost like it was a thing of its time, you know. I went there one time to take a look at it, and fantabulous place. I mean, it's just, you know, razzmatazz, just typical California place. It fulfilled itself, and now it's gone. So
that was one too that really they really invested a lot in TV ministry, right? This was the wave of the future, you know, both in terms of infrastructure building. So he wanted to build not only the giant parking lot and experience out there in California, but to do that everywhere for everyone. So, you know, build it and they will come kind of mentality. And then the shift to media, which worked for a time, but then ultimately they went bankrupt. And of course, now that facility is actually the new hub of the Orange County Catholic Diocese, which has been a really fascinating transition to watch as well. But I think it's at this moment we can think, okay, what is the new medium now, and how are religious denominations capitalizing upon media, social media, online, various forms in order to convey a message likewise. And maybe there's an opportunity there. You know, there are certainly different voices, a lot more voices really, who are in on this conversation. But I think the jury's still out as to whether it's going to be effective in the long run in terms of levels of affiliation or not.
Right. It's interesting to observe, you know, the ironies of God's universe sometimes. I remember back in the 70s and 80s, you know, an Indian guru named Sri Rajneesh bought a huge ranch in Oregon, and the thousands of people moved in, and they loved singing, chanting, and they were always making love. You know, the free love was part of their thing. And eventually they got kicked out, whatnot. And it was bought by the billionaire who brought in Young Life, which is, a young Christian teen group, organization, right? Who also like to sing, but no sex, you know, celibate.
Right.
So it's like, okay, yeah. You know, for some time in their history, they were one thing, and now they're this other thing. And, you know, interesting how things just morph and change, right?
They do. Even in the Catholic Church, you know, there was a massive change in the early 1960s with the Second Vatican Council, and you had...
Right.
You had mass in the language of the vernacular. So suddenly the mass was in English and Spanish and, you know, whatever the locals speak. But now we're seeing this resurgence of the Latin and this, you know, recalling of and a real interest in the heightened liturgy and the heightened ritual and the use of the Roman Missal according to 1962. So hearkening back pre-Vatican II. So I think there's a little bit of that too in this on the opposite end of the spectrum, right? This desire for a re-traditionalized faith, and perhaps it goes back to this this idea of apartness from the world. You know, if so many religions are doing so much that accommodate so many changes in modernity and being welcoming and progressively minded or otherwise, then maybe people start to say, well, if there's no difference between religion and anything else, then why go? Whereas the heightened level of tradition and re-traditionalization brings in, well, it's really different to walk into this space that feels holy. I put a veil over my hair. I smell the incense. I participate in Latin prayers. And that sense of reverence and separation for some, including many young people, is attractive. So I find that quite intriguing as well.
Well, and I think it connects you to the numinous, you know, to something more above and beyond the intellect, right? Where it was refreshing that the services could be done in English at that time,
sure.
Because it was like bringing it immediacy to us, perhaps, mm-hmm. You know. But now it's almost like we want the numinous. We want us to go beyond thinking, you know. And if I can't understand the words, it doesn't matter because I'm still partaking in that ritual. It's above and beyond. It speaks more intuitively or whatever. I know that's true for, you know, chanting in Sanskrit. It's, you know, I got a general idea of what the words mean, but I don't need to know, you know, because it takes me to a place that's beyond, you know, what I can work out for myself. And mm-hmm. And that's strangely comforting sometimes, you know, it's entering into a mystery, right? That can be deeply, deeply fulfilling, I think.
Yeah. It feels apart. It feels different. You know, I've been amazed when I go into parishes, especially personal parishes that are dedicated to the traditional Latin Mass in particular, just to see how popular they are, how many young people are there. It's a very different experience than the church and the Mass that emerged after Vatican II. And
right.
I think there's a generational piece of this too, in the sense that, you know, during Vatican II, so baby boomers, you know, that those generations saw the Catholic Church change during that time in a really phenomenal way. This was formative to their experience. Young Catholics didn't see the older version of the Mass. And they also didn't see the church change. And so I think too, even when it comes to all of these harder pieces about the reckoning, there's a very different generational relationship of Catholics to the church who are thinking through what does change look like and is change possible, because they were not alive during that time, to put it simply.
There's been a bit of a firestorm about Notre Dame and the money collected to restore it, you know, and people are saying, well, it should be given to the poor or whatnot. What's your view on that?
Of course, the Catholic Church is one of the largest charitable actors on the globe. And so I think that some have said, well, this is contributing to something more and bigger than this physical space. And then even the physical space, of course, links to the culture of France, you know, Catholics around the globe. And this building is so much more than a building. But I can understand certainly why there's there's some debate around this. And I think it's a question that is one that can be thought about in lots of communities around the globe, including in the United States. You know, what do we put our money into? And what is really, what is religion in some ways, right? Is religion the beauty of the church building that does symbolically act in certain meaningful ways for communities? Should that be saved? Or is it this investment in the infrastructure of the people and the poor and the social needs? Well, I don't have the answer to it. I actually do think it's been an occasion to be more thoughtful and reflective about, well, how do we invest in our community, and what does religion look like in this new age, as it were?
Yeah, yes, exactly. It's driven us to think through these things. I'm a both and person myself. You know, I think Jesus, you know, helped the poor and the weak and whatnot, but he also allowed expensive oil to be, you know, anointed upon him. And so the message there for me is, you know, both are acceptable. You know, there's limitless abundance in God's universe. Folks, let me tell you about next week's show, and then we'll say goodbye to Tricia, and she'll give us her website to get in touch with her. Sure. Next week, I have one of those weeks where I'm flying solo, and I'm going to discuss a topic near to my heart. So next week is Ask, Seek, Knock, Keys to Manifestation Using the Wisdom Teachings of Jesus and the Buddha. So if you want to know how to be in the flow, to be more helpful and compassionate as a person for yourself and others, tune in next week. But right now, Tricia, thank you so much for being on the show. You know, personally, I could go on for another couple of hours.
It was likewise. Well, we'll have to get coffee in person for that.
There we go. And so tell us quickly what your website is. And
yeah, sure. No, people can check me out, www.TriciaBruce.com, or follow me on Twitter at Tricia C. Bruce. And engage the conversation. Let's continue it.
Yeah, and I think everybody who's listened can attest to the fact that this has been a fascinating show with a very personable and intelligent and thoughtful person. So thank you for listening, and join us again on this Voice of an Awakening World. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye now.
Thanks for listening. This is Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Are you ready to experience the rich interconnection of spirituality, orientation, and identity? If so, plan to attend Liberating Your Divine Identity, a retreat at Unity Village during Pride Month, June 9th to the 12th. This soul-filled retreat is facilitated by LGBTQIA+ Unity Ministers, with workshops and ceremonies to cultivate a deeper awareness of our spiritual nature. Register at unityvillage.org/IAmDivine2022.